Forward Guidance is brought to you by Van Eck, a global leader in asset management since 1955. You'll be hearing more about Van Eck ETFs later on, but for now, let's get into today's interview. I'm joined by Ben Miller, founder and CEO of Fundrise. Ben, great to see you. How are you doing?
Great. Thanks for having me.
It's my pleasure. So you are deep in the real estate world and are a real estate investor. And obviously, I want to ask you about that. But I understand that you've been kicking the tires on debt, not just in the real estate world, but in the entire U.S. economy, federal debt, corporate debt, all types of debt, and looking at debt sustainability relative to GDP. And you have a really interesting way of looking at it. So first off, before I ask you your conclusions, how did you start to get into this wormhole of you were looking at debt to GDP? And what have you been finding?
The real estate industry went into a bit of a anaphylactic shock last year when interest rates went from 0 to 5.25, which meant you were borrowing at like 6 to 8, 6 to 10, depending on the spread. The challenge felt like a unique challenge in real estate. So, and that was that you had a property, and maybe that property was worth $10 million. And you had $1 million of income a year on it, so 10% a year. Like, we had loans with tons of banks. So this happened to us on a bunch of properties where you have a loan. The loan might be, for us, we were low leverage, like maybe only 60% leverage or something. So the loan $6 million, the property is worth 10, and the interest rate doubles. And so before you might have been paying 3%, and now you're paying 6. It was not about the, you know, most people think about like their, when they buy a home, they think about it, oh, 80% mortgage, can they afford, you know, do they have enough equity to write the check? And that what really matters is the DTI, the debt to income ratio. Like, that's the thing that's constraining every single home buyer. Like, the primary challenge you're trying to buy a home today is not that you don't have enough equity, not that you can't get the debt, but that the debt to income ratio you need at 7% mortgage is constraining most people from buying a home. And that's the same thing true with all commercial real estate. And then if you go and expand it out, look at all securitization, asset-backed securities, you start looking at like broader and broader borrowing bases, corporate sectors, you start seeing this pattern repeat. And so I just followed that pattern, you know, up and up and up. And I finally got to the entire United States. I just couldn't. And it was interesting because the Fed looks at the data of debt to collateral the way that like a lender does. So lenders will constrain you two ways, right? They'll look at it at LTC, LTV, so loan to value. So they may say 80% or 60%. And they'll also look at your debt to income ratio, or in commercial real estate, it's called DSCR, debt service coverage ratio, but it's a ratio of your income to the debt service, the annual mortgage payment. And there's no data on that for the country. Like, nobody aggregates all U.S. debt and all U.S. sort of income, which would be GDP or GNI, whichever one you want to use. When you look at it in totality, a lot of the conclusions people run around with in sort of popular FinTwit or popular economic policy wonks, like they're discordant. They're not consistent with the data. If you look at the U.S. as a whole, it was just really shocking to me.
Yes. And I think what you're referring to is, let's put up a chart of U.S. federal debt to GDP, which was, let's say, around 30 to 40% in the 1970s, is now around 120%. So that is an incredible rise. But that is only looking at U.S. federal government debt. There is also the private debt creation. And your findings are that the growth of that in the 1980s and 1990s and 2000s before 2008 was much, much bigger than it is now.
Yeah. So there's two points here. One, when I first started bringing this up, people started saying, well, it doesn't make sense to look at public and private debt combined. You know, so the government now has increased the amount of debt to GDP to 100%. But why would you look at that in totality? And to me, it's obvious, because if the government wanted to pay down their debt, they could tax the private sector or print money, right? Either way, it's that you can lower the debt load of the government by taking from the private sector. And then vice versa, the government can take on debt of the private sector, like what happened in the 2008 financial crisis, that is essentially the U.S. government monetized, took, you know, nationalized a lot of the debts of the private sector. And they arguably did that again in COVID when they were put $6 trillion into the economy to sort of stop the private sector from falling apart, and they nationalized private debts. So the debt load can move between the public and private sector based on politics and policy. And so you have to look at it in totality. You can't just look at U.S. If U.S., just as an example, if U.S. government debt was 100% of GDP and the private sector had zero debt, right? There was no debt in the rest of the economy. Like, it wouldn't matter. It wouldn't matter. And so that's like the main insight. And then once you go look at it in totality, rather than looking at government versus just, oh my gosh, government debts are spiraled in the last 15 years, your takeaways, my takeaways were totally different. And they defy the popular narrative. So this is like the all the debt in the US. It's a little bit outdated. It's now about 99 trillion. So this is everything: businesses, households, banks, and then government. And so, like, the question I asked, if you go to the next slide, the question I asked was, you know, was there faster debt growth in the 90s or in 2008, 2023? Like, I think the popular narrative is that recently there was huge debt growth because the government grew its debt so much. Actually, total debt growth has been slowing in the U.S., consistently slowing since the 80s. And that is shocking. Like, it's just the opposite of everybody believes. Everybody believes that there's debt growth has been, there's a debt spiral. And instead, debt growth has actually been at historic lows across all of the United States.
And this is all debt, as mm-hmm. you said. And so going back to this chart, bank debt, it's $21 trillion in bank debt you have there. I think the amount of bank deposits in the country are $17 trillion. So, but again, everything that we call bank debt is literally money, bank deposits. Of course, that's a liability for banks, an asset for you and me, but it is literally what we call money. So there's this concept of, like, debt is money, right?
Right. Credit is credit and capital. They're synonymous in the way that capital markets work.
Yes. So I think when people say that there is a debt bubble, what they may be saying is that the amount of credit growth and money growth, because credit and money are very similar, in some cases, literally the same thing, as we just said, that has been outpacing the growth of the economy. So money and credit is growing faster than the economy.
But that's actually not true. So this is the debt to GDP ratio. So in 1980, there was, like, let's say half as much debt as GDP, 0.6. And then by 1990, there was twice as much debt, 2.2 times as much debt as GDP. It rose all the way to 2008. So by 2008, there was 3.6 times more debt than GDP. But since 2008, it's been flat. It's gone down a little bit, but more or less flat. So actually, GDP has been growing as fast as debts.
Since 2008, yes.
Since 2008.
For all debt. So there was a huge debt boom from the 80s to until 2008 on pretty much all sectors. Since then, debt to GDP for all debt, as you say, good point, has been flat. However, federal debt to GDP has still exploded. So there actually has been a much more moderate growth in private sector debt. So, you know, corporate bonds, mortgages, and the like. And, you know, the U.S. household sector is, like, less levered now than it was in 2000.
Yeah, yeah. So, like, a lot of this analysis are, like, fractals. So we're talking about the biggest fractal, which is the U.S., and you can then go down into each sector. So previously I did, like, a commercial property fractaling up to, like, all business debt, you know, fractaling up to the U.S. But if you know, so, like, the strains that we're talking about could happen in a sector. Like, in 2008, the sector that couldn't afford its debt to income ratio was the banking sector, right? And then that cascaded to the household sector. One sector can break and because of these ratios. And so inside that, though, actually the only sector that really constrained debt growth was households. From 2008 to 2023, household debt growth was, like, a couple percent, was negligible. And businesses, banks, and governments were growing their debt by sort of normal high rates, which historically is about 8% a year. So it was only households that were constrained, responsible, however you want to describe it. And that's why households are so healthy today.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I think that's also maybe potentially why households are feeling under strain, because they couldn't borrow as much. And so as a result, like, the individual took the pain over the last decade and a half, and the businesses and banks and the government really didn't.
You said the word responsible, and I think that it definitely is possible that the growth in the federal debt now is irresponsible, but there also is a chance, like during the Great Depression, it was irresponsible that there was negative credit creation. You know, it's a balance, and it's also possible for there not to be too much. Although I'd say it's kind of a hard argument to say that on the federal government side, there's not enough debt. It's either the right amount or too much or way too much, but maybe it's not enough. I don't know.
Well, I'm not. I mean, I guess I'm not taking a view of the whether it's right or wrong. It's just that the question is what we can afford. The analysis is, okay, if you have 350% debt to GDP, right, which is 3.5 times the amount of GDP to debt, if the interest rate is double, can the U.S. afford to carry that?
So, Ben, I want to say a really important thing, that it's so the main metric, that of course, is a debt to GDP, but that is a metric of comparing debt, which is a amount of money, to a GDP, which is a flow of money. It's not like we have to pay 3 times as much in debt every year as our economy is. You know, it is very normal for that for a flow to be much smaller than a stock, and an appropriate way would be to look at the debt income service ratio. So how much is the U.S. government paying on its federal debt, corporates, how much are people paying on their debt every year? Compare that to GDP. That's what you've done. Whereas debt to GDP itself is, you know, I mean, if no one pays any money on any interest rate, if interest rates are zero, then debt to GDP could be infinity and it would cost nothing, you know?
Yeah, it's called Japan.
Yeah.
There's stock and flow, and you need to look at the volume of stock, and the volume of stock increased 5.5 times over the, you know, this period from the 80s to 2008. And now we end up with a lot of debt. And when we end up with a lot of debt, the way we managed it over the last 15 years is we kept interest rates low. So we could afford it because interest rates, you know, Fed funds rates were close to zero. ZERP was a policy. And so we had a lot of debt, but it was actually manageable from like a debt to income ratio. Because if the house you can afford to buy when your mortgage is 3% versus the house you can afford to buy when your mortgage is 7, you just can't afford as much house because you can't afford to carry the mortgage. And so the consequence of higher for longer is that debt to income ratio is going to rise. And I feel like what's missing from the debate about interest rates and inflation is a long-term view. Most people are talking about 2024, maybe 2025. But if you look at it on a longer term basis, just pure fundamentals, can the U.S. afford to have 50%, it's approximately 50% higher annual debt payments? Because the average mortgage in the U.S. in the 2010s was about 4%, and the average mortgage is a little hard to forecast, but maybe it's 6%, maybe it's 7%. Today it's 7%. But even if it's 6%, that's 50% higher. And so how many people, how many businesses, how many banks can afford 50% higher debt service? Not the majority. The majority cannot. And so it's the interesting view. My view on higher for longer is that, you know, anything is feasible in the short run. That's why bubbles exist. But on the long run, it's completely infeasible to be able to carry that, unless the U.S. has explosive growth. So you'd have to grow into that. And even then, you'd have to have interest rates come down. Like the idea that we're at 3.5% inflation, you know, permanently would mean that we're have a mortgage rate in the 6 to 7% at least. And the U.S., you know, the U.S. has too much debt. So the point of a no landing scenario is like an airplane. Like, okay, there's no landing until you run out of gas. Like there's no such thing as no landing, right? Eventually the airplane has to land or crash.
Yeah.
And so by persisting in the short-term view about inflation, you're headed down the path of financial crisis.
In 2017, Forward Guidance's exclusive sponsor, VanEck, was the first ETF issuer to file for a Bitcoin-linked ETF. 7 years later, Bitcoin ETFs are finally available. Using the VanEck Bitcoin Trust ticker HODL, you can invest in Bitcoin with zero fees until March 31st, 2025. That's right, zero fees until March 31st, 2025. Search the ticker HODL in your brokerage app today or visit vaneck.com/HODLFG to learn more. Now, the disclosures. An investment in the VanEck Bitcoin Trust, also known as the Trust or HODL, involves significant risk and may not be suitable for all investors. You could lose your entire investment. The Trust offers fewer investor protections as it is not registered under the Investment Company Act of 1940 or as a commodity pool under the Commodity Exchange Act. For a complete discussion of the risk factors relative to the Trust, carefully read the prospectus link below. You can learn more about HODL and its zero fees until March 31st, 2025 at vaneck.com/HODLFG. That's vaneck.com/HODLFG. And now back to the interview.
Why can the economy not handle 5% interest rates if it handled them in the mid to late 1990s, like 1998, let's say, and there was a boom? I mean, there, the U.S. household was probably more levered in 1998 than it is now. And then the real black sheep is the government. So if the government was the household sector, there would be definitely some financial issues with the rise in interest rates, but the government can always just print money. But that's a different sector. But where are you seeing the strains of households, real estate, businesses, large corporations, the government? Who is 5% interest rates hurting the most now, and who is it going to hurt the most in this longer term concern that you have?
I mean, so the reason the U.S. could afford 7% mortgages in the 90s was that there was a lot less debt. Right, there was 2x debt to GDP in the 90s, and now they're 3.5x. So there's,
in the early 1990s,
in the early 90s or take the 80s. In the 80s, there was half as much debt as GDP. Imagine having GDP of today, our GDP is $27 trillion. Imagine only having $14 trillion of debt in the United States. It's like nothing, right? So the reason the U.S. could have, like during Volcker, when you had this 21% interest rates, the reason that we could afford that is that there was so little debt in the country. So that's why. You can't look at the past and say, well, we used to have, mortgages used to be 6-7% and Fed funds used to be 5% and it was fine. Is that the total debt load is just so much higher. So there's not a good extrapolation that's missing a huge part of the equation. So that's like at the highest level. Then you can telescope down and say, okay, what's happening? And you can pick your industries. And you can take real estate, but you can look at down the line. And the only thing that matters is whether or not your debt has reset to the higher rate. Like whether every sector, that's the only question that matters, is maturity.
And explain that concept for our audience a little bit, Ben, please.
What's special about this, how this time is different, is that we had 0%, I'm just going to round it to 0% interest rates for about 12 to 13 years. So it normalized into our society. And so you could get long-term fixed rate debt. Like the difference between the 2008 financial crisis and this time is back in the 2005, 2006, 2007, you couldn't get 30-year fixed at 3%. That wasn't, the long end of the curve didn't come down. The only way you could get really low rates was with an ARM. So everybody, when the Fed dropped rates down to 1%, Greenspan dropped rates down from basically 5.5 to 1 during the tech bubble, 01, 02, 03, rates were low from about 3 or 4 years. And then they brought them back up to 5.25. And in order to capitalize in that really low interest rate environment, you had to take relatively short-term debt, 3-year, 5-year, maybe 7-year at most. It didn't take long for the interest rate environment to reset to the higher rate. There was very, very, very few companies and borrowers who the long end of the curve was never, close to the front end of the curve. Front end of the curve fell in 03 and 02. Mm-hmm.
But extremely steep yield curve, yeah.
Yeah, but that didn't happen. But that didn't, in the 2010s, people started to believe it was going to be lower forever. So you could go out and get, I mean, you saw, right? Like Austria got a 100-year bond or something at like next to nothing. So there were negative interest rates, you know, trillions, tens of trillions of negative interest rates. So the world had fixed a lot of debts long-term at super low rates. So as a consequence, that's like the most, that's the biggest asset. And as that debt like matures or rolls over, that's the biggest trigger to financial distress or economic slowdown. And so if you go to look at any sector, you could look at real estate, commercial real estate, home mortgages, small business, consumer borrowing. If you look at any one of those sectors, the only question you have to ask is about the duration of their debts.
I'm looking at the household debt, and that is 73% debt as a percentage of GDP, which is down from the peak of 100% in 2008. And it's a little bit above the mid-60s average of the 1990s. It's not super high. It's lower than it's been than any time in the past 15 years.
Right. That's exactly what everybody talks about. Debt to income as a ratio rather than debt to, they look at the stock. That's a stock analysis.
Yes.
How much debt, how much collateral. But if you took it by math, right? So this, if you had 75% debt at 4% mortgage, 75% debt at 7% mortgage, virtually nobody can afford a 7% mortgage, even with 75% debt, because you essentially at that point have taken the effective collateral up by 50 to 65%.
Okay, I'm looking at a chart from Fred that says household debt services as a percentage of disposable personal income, and it is lower now than any time in the 1980s and 90s.
Right, exactly, because the whole world fixed to the low interest rate environment that now I think people believe is gone forever. And so then the primary asset of any individual, any company, or any like sector is that long-term fixed rate debt. So, but it's essentially a wasting asset, right? It's not like you own NVIDIA that's like a growing asset. I mean, like everybody who has these debts, slowly but surely they expire, they mature, and as they do, right? That's what slows the economy down, and that's the sort of like the axe will fall. And the only chance is like if you take a company, right? Because these are fractals, you can go up and down in terms of telescoping. You know, company says, okay, well, if we grow enough, we can afford it when it comes due, right? If we can just grow, like if you're a highly indebted business, but you can double your top line and your bottom line, then you'll be fine. So growth is the only solution, but these growth rates are challenging. I mean, it's a race. That's why I call it a race between growth and debts, because the debts don't come down. Debt interest rates don't come down. Then their only hope for the country is high growth, and the higher the rates like normalize to, the more growth we need. We need a lot of if rates normalized where they are today, which is 3.5% inflation, which would probably be at about 4.5 Fed funds rate,
mm-hmm.
right? About 1% of real interest rate. And then long end of the curve, what's a 200?
Five, six.
Yeah, like not 50 pips wide, right? Probably 5.5 to 6. And then you're borrowing at a 200 spread over that. So you're talking about borrowing at 7 to 8%. Like there's no way anybody who's listening to this podcast, if their mortgage reset to 8%, that they could afford their house.
Yes, but that is why the prepayment rate on mortgages has collapsed from, you know, I think it peaked at like 40 or 50% in the boom days of 2020. And now it's like 4%. So 4% of people, that means 96% of people who have a mortgage stay in it every year. Mm-hmm. I think that's how you interpret the statistic. And that's because, their mortgage is 4%. I don't know exactly what it is, but let's say on average 4%, 5%. 4%, let's say. The spot mortgage rate is, I mean, you know it to the basis point, but like way, way higher than that. So the only reason you would do that is if you, you know, have to move out, there's a divorce, you have to move for a job, something like that. Like real stuff comes in the way. But yeah, it's pretty good. I mean, 30 years is a pretty long time.
Well, yeah. So I have like two counterpoints to that. So first is you're extrapolating a small part of the market. Very little of the market is 30-year fixed. Of the $100 trillion in debt, you're talking about a really small part of all debt. I mean,
but a large part of the household debt.
Yeah. So there's, I mean, I had this and then I can't remember off the top of my head. I think it was like 13 trillion, was it? I can't remember. It's in my deck if you have the slide. But so we also buy asset-backed securities and we're on the securitization side. We buy kind of all sides of the market. And if you go buy a mortgage today, let's say, new issuance are 7% mortgages. Like I like that mortgage. Or I say, I like this mortgage that's like, there's a 4% mortgage out there, right? And it's underwater, so reset to higher rates. The bond market assumes that a 4% mortgage will have an 8.5-year duration.
Mm-hmm.
So 8.5 years is like, that's not 30 years, right? So which is in my analysis. I have a page that looks at like, what do we think the average duration of all U.S. debt is? And I even expanded. I said, okay, if 8.5 years, maybe it's even wider because it's assuming a falling forward curve. So maybe it's 10 years, but that's only a percentage. How many people own houses? How many people don't own houses? You would, the consequences to U.S. dynamism, if essentially your main asset is a long-term fixed rate debt, is like kind of like the Great Stagnation, where you can't move. Nobody can buy a new house. Like there's like huge negative consequences. And again, of the $100 trillion in debt, you're maybe talking about 6-7% of it that's really long-term 30-year fixed rate debt. So it's not the households are the part of the economy I think is like most resilient, sort of the best positioned.
Yeah, we got 13 trillion in home mortgages. A large percent of that is fixed debt. Yeah, compared to the $100 trillion in overall debt, it's not. But again, we agree that the household debt is what households and businesses is what matters. I mean, some people disagree, but the government, the demand for U.S. Treasuries is quite high for U.S. debt.
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm optimistic about the household, but you have to look at the economy in a little more. You have to get under the hood.
Yeah, let's do it.
So you get under the hood and you say, okay, well, what percentage of the economy, what of the households that we were talking about have this wonderful fixed rate debt? So it's mostly boomers. It's older. The older you are, the more likely to have it. The less money you have, the less likely you are to have it. So you end up now with like an economy that's on like so two Americas again, where you have a huge part of the economy, at least half of the economy, all young people will not have this asset and will struggle. And then the rest of the economy, the older people, wealthier people, like will be fine. And so what does that do to the economy? I mean, it's not really clear, but I think that like there's political consequences, economic consequences. If the typical entrepreneur is a young person, I mean, most of the dynamism in the country comes from people who are kind of rising generation. So you can imagine a scenario where we keep higher for longer and half the country is fine with that, half the country is suffering enormously. Same with businesses. So it's the same story over and over again. Like if you look at the corporate markets, you have like NVIDIA and big AAA rated getting like super cheap debt. And you have a small business that can't, if they can get debt at all, they're going to pay huge rates. So like that doesn't seem sustainable to me. Let's talk about real estate for a second.
Yeah.
So real estate. So the biggest problem in real estate today is the office industry. By way of background, people like we own $7-8 billion in real estate. We own one office building in our portfolio, so it's like negligible because I never liked office. I bought office and I managed office and I never liked office. Office is a multi-trillion dollar part of the market, let's say $3 trillion. It's most of the office is probably zero equity. Like the equity is zeroed. I'd argue, and I have lots of office people who get mad when I say this, that all office is zeroed. And then probably half the debt. So there's this like massive economic bomb that went off in office. And this is, everybody knows this, but if you look at the second order consequences of that, so now you have, I think it's like a couple hundred billion square feet of office in downtowns in particular that need to get economically like revived. They need tons of money to renovate, to tear down, to redo. there's this massive economic demand need, because as you take Washington DC or San Francisco or any of these cities, a collapsed downtown where you have vacant office buildings is a economic crisis for those cities. And I'm already seeing it where school budgets are getting cut and they're trying to figure out how to make up the hole. And if interest rates stay high for longer, it's going to be really difficult to afford any of the economic revitalization you need for those cities. So you're talking about long-term decay to downtowns, which is like a second order consequence of higher for longer. If you get into the math, which I could get into, you could see why that's true, but you couldn't afford to take a, you know, massive office building and redo the whole thing with equity financing. Like that's, and today debt costs as much as equity. So that's why office buildings are trading at such low prices, $100 a square foot versus $700 a square foot 36 months ago, is that they're unfinanceable. And that's happened before in the 80s in real estate in downtowns. I'm like old enough to remember that, where the riots in 1968, you know, and the white flight crushed downtowns and the cities went into huge economic decay. And so again, like probably the country can afford higher for longer, but we'll have very concentrated costs.
Ben, earlier we talked about the fixed rate mortgage. So the vast majority of individual residential mortgages, like, oh, I own a home and I have a mortgage on it, a person saying that is fixed rate mortgage. Maturity of 15 or 30 years, you said a duration of 8, which factors in the prepayment thing that I said. The pain for the fixed rate people is not here yet, and it's going to be many years. The pain for the floating rate people is not only here, it was here a year ago, 18 months ago, and the floating rate people, but correct me if I'm right, Ben, is your world of the commercial real estate building. I mean, you're not buying a house for your family, you're buying an office building for people to work in, then you rent it out, or an apartment building. You're in the apartment building world, you're not in the office world. You said, you know, negligible exposure to offices, but is it accurate to say that the floating rate pain of rising interest rate is a huge, huge, huge amount of that is on the commercial real estate side, not residential?
Yeah, I would broaden that a little bit in that the reason you have 30-year and 15-year fixed rate mortgages for households is that there's government subsidized.
Yep, absolutely.
So like to think that's the norm is people are extrapolating what they see in their life to every other part of the sector, but banks, corporate sector, businesses, any kind of professional, that is, nobody's borrowing 15 to 30 year except for like Microsoft.
Very few other countries have a 30-year fixed rate mortgage. Yeah.
Yeah. So you're, you know, 90% of the money, 90% of the debt, if not more, is duration of a few years. Like US federal debt's duration is 6 years. And this was one of the things that shocked me, and you probably know more about it than me, but like only 10% of all US federal debt is 30-year fixed. Like it's a really small percentage of it. And that's true with like, if you're a real estate company or you're a small business or even a middle market business, you're going to borrow 5-year debt. That's the duration. Typically a bank and an investor securitization markets, they don't want to go beyond 10 years. And so you're talking about most of the market is either short-term floating or 3 to 7 year duration. And so every year, a big part of the market's resetting because they don't have very long dated debt. And that's like what's happening in the real estate industry, where you have, and I just take real estate as a microcosm of this, where every year there's, you know, a couple $100 billion of debt that comes due and resets the higher rate. And every time that happens, you are like likely to have to delever, because if you have a property that can't support its debt service, it needs less debt. And so somebody has to write a check and deleverage that property. And what that does is it soaks up liquidity. Liquidity starts going out of the market because debt is money. And so as you deleverage, you have you should have declining M2, declining money supply, which we know we have, but money velocity has basically compensated for it. That's a point in time, though. But again, if you go to the higher for longer, you play it out over a few years, 3 years from now, 4 years from now, it's completely unsustainable. And that the disadvantage of higher for longer is that you end up with a more concentrated, you know, a breakdown rather than a soft landing. This is the problem with the market, is that it always extrapolates the present into the future. And so today, the fact that the present is healthy with a 3.5% inflation rate, they extrapolate that forward and assume that's just like in 2021, they extrapolated 2021's craziness forward, or 2018 when interest rates were nearly zero. Like the market over extrapolates the present into the future, and it's doing it again.
So we know commercial real estate is the locus of the pain of higher interest rates. How bad is it now? Because, you know, 18 months ago, there were a lot of commercial real estate developers, very large developers, who, you know, would go on TV and say, this is going to cause, you know, an apocalypse in the commercial real estate world. And I'm sure the past 18 months hasn't been great, but I mean, the unemployment rate remains below 4%. It has not had a broad impact at all. Like, has it gotten steadily worse, just as, you know, okay, the interest rate shock of the overnight rate, by the beginning of 2023, most of the hikes were already there. It's just that the cutting that was priced into the forward market has just been moved up. So the 1 year, the 2 year, the 3 year, 4 year, 5 year has been moved up as well. And that's where a lot of the activity is, as you know, borrowing activity is as well. So how would you say it is there? How has that impacted the space?
The market is reflexive, and the expectation of the market was that rates were going to be high in the short term and come down in the medium to long term. And the forward curve, or the Fed funds dot map, showed it at, you know, 5.25, but getting down to 2.5 or into the twos by 2028. And it was a steady decline. And so what you could do as a borrower, you could create synthetic ways to bridge that gap, you know, with derivatives. But everybody at the table, all the banks, all the borrowers, the regulators, you know, the FDIC regulators, all look at that and say, well, clearly the answer is to just get to the other side of this bump, you know, get to the other side of the slope, so that because this thing can clearly pencil at a 2.5% Fed funds rate or 3.5, whatever you say, and the forward curve and the long term interest rates of, you know, at various points last year, long term 10-year mortgages were in the threes, 3.8, 3.9, and so as long as the long term interest rate was way inside the short term, everybody was complicit in delaying, because that's what the forward curve tells you. It tells you basically, if you just wait a year or two, this problem goes away. The moment that's not true, there's a crisis.
Well, it's not true now. I mean, we got a one cut priced in, but I guess you got the reprieve. Interest rates are about as restrictive as they were in October, of late October. The Federal Reserve pivoted in its narrative. No pivot in rates, but it pivoted in its narrative in November. Then 6 cuts were priced for this year at around the beginning of this, of 2024. Now it's, you know, then 5, then 4. Now it's less than 3, which the Fed has, you know, it's less. The market is now pricing in fewer cuts than the Federal Reserve indicated on its dot plot. And I mean, now it's maybe even less than 1. Maybe, sorry, less than 2 by
yeah.
the end of the year.
And again, you're talking about really short term.
Yeah, yeah.
But the you know, most
you're talking 5 year, I'm talking within the 1 year. Yeah.
Yeah, just, you know, we'll split the difference and say 2 to 3. Let's say 3. And so most banks and the regulators, the FDIC regulators, are explicit in like letting the banks extend and pretend, blend and pretend. That's like part of the policy. So everybody at the table, if you're a business, if you're a bank, if you're a debt fund, if you're a real estate company, they're all looking at it and saying, okay, well, if we just wait a year, okay, we waited a year, if we wait another year. And so like the market's fighting them, because without that kind of pain, it's hard to have the rate environment come back down. So the rate environment can't come down until that pain is taken, because everybody sees that forward benefit of waiting. They delay. Like, this happened briefly in October. In October, when the 10-year treasury went to 5%, like, there was cracks developing. And then, you know, Janet Yellen came out with the and did a little fancy footwork, and then we saw some the dot map, and people got optimistic, and they delayed again. So
the rates went down. Yeah,
the rates came back down, and now we're basically on that roller coaster again. And this time is a little different than October because we're really starting to see that that inflation might be stuck at 3.5%. Or whatever, I don't, you can pick your, you know, whatever, CPI, PPI, blah, 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 but it's stuck higher. And so it's, again, this reflexivity. The moment the market decides that we're really are higher forever is when you're moments away from the financial crisis. You know, that's one alternative. The other one is that rates do come down, inflation does come down. It's just like, it's a grindy process. And because nobody wants it, there's enough. You know, there'll just be like a, you know, some decline of you know, office market is going to have some pain. And I mean, it's not just office. I mean, like a lot of residential in apartments are too levered. Leverage was cheap and during the last heyday, the last cycle. So private equity is high leverage, levered loan. I mean, there's a lot of parts of the sector. So it's a. What everybody wants is something simple, and this is complicated. There's a, you know, I don't know, 100 million different borrowers who are all trying to figure this out, and each one of them is suffering to some extent as they look forward and deal with this. And so the Fed's hope is that it's like you see the marginal decline day by day, and that slows everything down, and that, you know, it's like we're living. You look back at the Fed data. And you always see the Fed, like the Fed talks like a trader, but acts like an accountant, right? So the we're living why the Fed always ends up doing what it always has done, which is that it, by the time it does anything, it's too late. And you're seeing why they don't have a choice. They can't get ahead of it. Like if they got ahead of it, they would have stopped a crisis that no one believes is going to happen.
Higher for longer interest rates are unequivocally bad for the real estate, commercial real estate industry, because nearly all of the commercial real estate industry is levered. So, you know, interest expenses are higher. It ruins the profitability of a lot of deals. In some cases, makes them non-economic, so that the value of the earnings every year, net operating income, is in some cases less than the debt costs. You said in October, cracks were beginning to form. What did you mean? And maybe cracks are beginning to form now. What do you mean? Because, you know, we've had a few niche developers on some apartment building in, you know, California or so, whatever, default and go bad, but it really hasn't gone systemic yet at all. And by systemic, it hasn't gone into the broader economy. It hasn't even gone into the rest of the commercial real estate market, right? Like there's very few failures. You know, show me the failures, Ben, and then I'll give you the crisis. But
at that point, it's too late. So you saw the cracks in the regional banking again in October. Like it happened in March. It started happening again in October. The weak link here is the regional bank. And the regional bank is the reason why the big banks are fine. And you maybe you already know all this, but there's 75% of all deposits are with 15 banks. So it's super concentrated.
I mean, yeah, I knew it was, yeah, but I didn't know that stat. That's good.
Yeah, it's wild. And then you know this, but JP Morgan's deposit rates 0.05%. You know, Wells Fargo deposit rates 0.01. So the big banks have all the deposits and they haven't. They basically borrow at zero and they lend at 6-7%, 8%. So it's an incredible market inefficiency that shouldn't exist. The depositors will leave 75% of their deposits at banks that are paying close to 0%. But that's actually the reality. And then for the other 25% of assets are with banks that are having to pay 5% for deposits and they have negative leverage, right? Because they most of their assets are on long-term, the long-term fixed rate mortgages they made before 2022. And so they're underwater. And so as the credit portfolio starts to deteriorate, right? Like, which is today, I mean, something like Fifth Third Bank said they had zero defaults, like zero credit losses last year or something. And I'm like, okay, well, that's illustrating my point, is that everybody's kicking the can. The reality, this is the savings and loan crisis. This is exactly what happened in the 70s and 80s. So we're just seeing it all happen again for all the same reasons. And that crisis, like, right, just to summarize that, because everybody's as familiar with the SNL crisis, is that all the banks lent at 5% from 1950s to 1970s, and the 1970s interest rates went to 20%, and that made all these banks go underwater. And you're talking about the SNL crisis happens in 1987, 1988, 1989, and that same era had they delayed for half a decade.
Extend and pretend?
That one was much more government focused. What they did in that era is they said, okay, we'll deregulate these banks and they can kind of, like, you know, they're underwater, so they'll grow their way out. And instead what the banks did was just bet the farm with government money. So that was not a good idea. And it cost, you know, at the time it cost $1 trillion, you know, the equivalent. So, I mean, it's different, but that was the worst real estate crisis, and way worse than 2008, like way worse. So,
For commercial real estate, you're saying?
For real estate, all real estate, not just commercial.
No, but the Case-Shiller, the, like, residential home prices did not decline by as much as they did during 2008, right?
Yeah.
In your world, definitely. I'm sure you're right.
Yeah,
about
yeah.
That.
I guess
for most people, the real estate market means housing.
Yeah. I mean, commercial is confusing to a lot of people because it can include home builders and include all different kinds of people who touch the real estate industry as professionals, rather than the resident, the consumer of the real estate versus the producer and investor in the real estate. So yeah, that there was it wiped out the real estate industry and it rebirthed it. And that's what created the public REIT industry. Didn't exist. There was basically no public REITs before 1990. And now it's $1 trillion. There was no private equity, real estate private equity didn't exist. CMBS, commercial mortgage-backed securities didn't exist. All these industries that were basically birthed, each became a $1 trillion industry. And there's part of the rebirth. And like, that's the kind of risks we're talking about, you know, where you have industries go to zero. And that's an extreme policy error for that to happen.
Right. And so you're talking about the banks. So JP Morgan, they for new depositors or whatever, they do pay 5 basis points. But I think if you're negotiating and you have a savings account and CDs, like, I think they're net cost of deposits is in the mid twos. And JP Morgan actually is one of the very few banks. Their net interest margins have gone up as because interest rates rose so quickly. So, like, Bank of America, they had a bunch of long dated paper mortgage-backed securities, which is what you referenced. So that's mostly on the interest rate risks on both sides of the yield curve for banks. But I'm talking about, let's just stay within the commercial real estate world. I mean, how bad is it? Is it now in terms of, I imagine, like, if you have the cycle that you envision, is interest expense is too much? So what? Then developers have to put in new equity, or they have to sell properties. And then if everyone tries to sell at once, prices go down, it spirals on that. Like, what stage of that are you in? Are we in right now? Like, give us the color of what you're seeing in your world. The
crazy thing is we're still early stages. Like, this is, for us, we're low leverage. We delevered, like, we went into 2020, I think 2023, with $750 million of cash. So we were like, so it's a gift for buyers. But you'll see on Twitter, right? You're seeing a slow number of defaults. I don't mean to pick on Fifth Third, but just happen to see them. So they'll go from, oh, it's zeroed, and they'll start having more credit like write downs and losses and markdowns and so that's probably a multi-year process. You know, if we're talking about rates to stay higher, and there's a deterioration in their in regional bank balance sheets, and there's sort of no way for them to rebuild that, right? Because there's no net margin income spread, their assets. They're competing against JP Morgan that has a 2% weighted cost of capital, and then you have like a regional bank that sits maybe 5% or 6% or something, and so they can't this is exactly what happened in the SNL crisis. They can't grow their way out of it, and slowly but surely the credit, like, eats away their equity.
And so you think that prices that you could buy real estate at have not gone down enough to represent the deterioration in the asset class, mainly caused by, and the deterioration in the deals and the profitability mainly caused by higher interest rates.
Higher interest rates and the second order consequences of that. So here, let's talk about, so Blackstone bought AIR a couple days ago, right? Mm-hmm. You saw that transaction. So it's a $10 billion purchase approximately, and they paid a 4.9% cap rate. So, right. So that's what's that multiple? 20 multiple? A five is a 20. 25. Mm-hmm. So, okay. That is not a distressed price. Right. Right. So, and that's a good comp for people who are saying like, well, I should just wait. And there's, it's almost a metaphor going back to the two Americas. If you have money and you're in good shape, you can afford to pay a great price and you can sell at a good price. And if you don't, it's like probably half. It's just catastrophically different. So there's this, you're seeing it in the market where some things are zero and some things are a price like it was in 2021. I mean, it's this bifurcated market. It's hard to have a clean narrative because you have this bifurcated dynamic in the market.
Blackstone bought AIR apartment income REIT, and so you said a 4.9% cap rate. So that sounds, yeah, as you said, kind of low. So good high valuation. So good for sellers. What is Blackstone's roughly cost of debt? I mean, if is it higher than 4.9%? And if so, would that constitute negative leverage, as in borrowing costs exceed income?
I'm sure they assumed a decent amount of low cost debt that was already in the portfolio. And so I haven't, our team is doing an underwrite of that deal, try to understand like what was underneath of it. I don't want to speak out of turn here, but the point is it's a comp. My point, which I'm just trying to stay high level for a minute, and also Blackstone is one of the smartest real estate investors around. And so you never want to presume anything. So, but it does show that there for people who can afford to wait out the high interest rates, there's like clearly a reason to. And then if you can't afford to wait, the question you keep asking is kind of, when does the bell ring, and where does it ring? You never can know, other than you can know it always happens. And like the soft landing presumption is entirely predicated on falling interest rates. Like there's no such thing as a soft landing without interest rates falling.
For the economy, it's possible. You're saying for the commercial real estate world, there's no way.
Well, that's for sure. I'm a skeptic. I mean, again, there are some real positive with AI, and I think the Great Stagnation is over. So I think we can grow our way out of it. But it's typically the economy is so deeply interconnected, it's hard to see a major part of the economy go into crisis and have it not have knock-on effects. But yeah, for commercial real estate, for sure, if rates don't come down, then it'll be like the biggest problem, the biggest opportunity, depending on which side of the side of the ledger you're on. But that's a fact.
Has there ever been a time in your career in real estate where you've seen it this bad?
Yeah, well, I've been in real estate for 20 plus years. So I was there in 08. 08 was definitely worse, way worse. And it was different. It was different because for a lot of these reasons. So it doesn't feel like 08. I mean, I'm kind of obsessed with history, and I just think it's more like the SNL crisis. It's more like what happened with the savings and loan than the savings and loan crisis. Just to recapitulate that for a second, is this, you know, people don't even know what a savings and loan is, but there are banks. There used to be banks and savings and loans, and banks did commercial lending, and savings and loans did home lending. The savings and loans, basically, they did so badly, they're basically gone, right? That's what I think is what we could see happen, that you see community and small and regional lending just go away. Like a decade from now, it took a long time for the SNL crisis to play out. I'm going to just round it to a decade. So a decade from now, there are 15 banks left in America. I mean, like, it's an extreme, but it's more like that than the present. This is what happened last time. The policy response will be to try to prevent that from happening. government will say, well, we don't want to have 15 banks in America that are super concentrated in New York and all these things. And so they're going to start trying to stop that, which is exactly what happened to the S&L crisis, which then made it 10 times worse. The facts are that if they just dealt with the problem initially back in like 83, it would have been a $50 billion write down. And instead they waited until late 80s and ended up being, 10 times, 20 times that.
Ben, I'm really glad that you have this. You're talking all about the negatives of commercial real estate, and you're in the space. So I'm glad you're not one of those people who's only talking about the positives. But in the multifamily apartment building world, isn't it fair to say that the fundamentals are still maybe decent in terms of occupancy rates? There's a lot of demand for housing, maybe not so much on the office side. Demand is an issue there, but the fundamental cash flow nature of the property is good. And I'll say the knockoff effect for that, that's good for real estate developers, but bad for people is higher rent, which rent has been very, very growing very, very, very rapidly. Although I've heard that actually the official statistics from in the CPI are way, way, way behind.
Yeah. Okay. Well, so yeah, I have a tendency, my whole view, it's like a Seth Klarman, like if you take care of the downside, the upside will take care of itself. And so I have a obsession with downside. And but the bull case on apartments, and I think also industrial, and is what I'm seeing on the ground. So last year there was negative rent growth in a lot of markets, but we're starting, and we have a lot of, we have tens of thousands of apartments. So we are across the Sun Belt. So I have I'm talking across a large portfolio. So there's some that were different than others, but the inflation in rents is very close to inflation at headline now, 3.5%, something like that, which is normal for rent growth. 3% used to be the institutional norm. And so if you are looking out and this is again both my bull case and in a way my base case for multifamily, is that there is no new construction happening in multifamily, but there is population growth, especially in the Sun Belt. You I think Texas added like half a million people last year, not including migrants. And so there is, if you go out and look at 2025, 2026, which is not that far away for real estate, there's going to be a supply constraint and rents should be healthy. Occupancy should be really tight. And so you can see a very positive forecast for apartments if you have low leverage and you have good assets. And there's a lot of operational work. Today, the shift has gone from cap rate compression did everybody's work last decade, like falling multiples made prices go up. And so now operating excellence is how you drive returns. And so there's just a lot of low-hanging fruit. And so if you have real estate at the current marks, you have to have a real estate at the mark of the present, which is not the crazy prices from 2021. It's just all the fundamentals are healthy and normal, and that's basically means that you get normal healthy returns, and they're not like they're not overpriced. Like you look at some parts of the stock market, and there's some parts of it seem like pricey, and you may not be so optimistic about like earnings growth or something, but if you've reset prices, if you've gotten to sort of the other side of what was a bubble in real estate, you have like a really nice sort of straightaway kind of almost boring a few years. I mean, then the upside pop is if rates do come down.
You said no new construction right now. You mean no deals are being done that tomorrow the backhoe is going to go into the ground? There is a lot of deals that were done in 2020, 2021 that are still under construction that are going to come online.
Yeah. So there's a lot, we do a lot of lending to multifamily construction. And so, a lot of stuff went, a lot of shovels went on the ground in 2021 and 2022 that delivered last year and this year, but the ability to green light a new project has fallen, in my anecdotal experience, like 90%. The amount of new supply that's going to come after this current wave is negligible. And so there's like a temporary spike in new supply, especially in a few markets that were just excessive, like Nashville, Austin. I mean, it's excessive overbuilding, especially.
I've seen Austin's overbuilding, yeah.
Especially infill towers.
What does that mean, infill towers?
I mean, you take a city like Austin, it's a huge city, right? So you can be out in the suburbs and a green area that's a, you know, four-story walk-up, or you can be, you know, we do build for rent. You can have a 200-home community where people rent the homes, and or you can be in this sort of black marble 30-story glass tower, right? Those are really different kinds of apartments. And some of the cities that overbuilt built these sort of these towers in the middle of like the Gulch or middle of the city, and those are really going to suffer.
Like luxury properties in the hottest neighborhoods.
Yeah. At the highest density, like because you could supply, you could build tall, you could really oversupply a local submarket. And so you have this concentrated oversupply. You might have three towers like across the street from each other delivering within the same 18 months. And then they have these, you know, interest rates that are like 7, 8, 9%. Those properties are probably end up wiped out because they're just getting hit on all sides. One of the reasons why those things got built is a hidden, say, I think a lot of economists miss that what drives the market is supply of money. And so the supply of money has a preference to large checks. And so a large check is what facilitated all those new deals. They're big deals, really expensive. You know, those deals probably cost $100, $200 million to build.
For one building.
For one building. Yeah. Yeah. Huge. Really huge. I mean, that's.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so a large check is like when you have oversupply of money like you did in 2021, the downstream consequences of that are large funds that need to write large checks, and they end up doing the same thing, right? They end up having the structure dictates behavior. And so the structure of their fund dictated they write large checks into certain, you know, institutionally acceptable markets, which were Austin and Nashville and maybe like Tampa or Orlando. And that sort of herd behavior is going to have then a high cost consequence.
Got it. You said you also do build for rent. Tell us about that. Is that single family or apartment buildings?
So we, for the last few years, have been focused on trying to build homes for rent. So we would buy 50 acres in Nashville or Charlotte, and then partner with a home builder who would build 150 homes, and then we would rent them and operate them. They operate like an apartment building. We have a leasing center and a pool and a fitness center, and we manage all the, you know, the lawn, landscaping. And so it's like a
community. It's like a condo like thing.
It's like an apartment building. We originally used to call it a horizontal multifamily. Mm-hmm. And then they invented the term build for rent. But it's like, if you say, oh, hire for longer, people can't afford to buy homes, but they want to live in a home. They have kids. They want a backyard. Like that's a better product. So I think we're the third biggest build for rent, sort of dedicated build for rent owner in the country. We have about 5,000 build for rent homes. We're building, that's one of the things we're still building and buying. The long-term demographic and sort of like consumer behavior trends around it are extraordinarily attractive to me. And so we've been doing that for last about more than four years now. We started in 2019.
I know there are some people in real estate who are immensely bullish on housing regardless of the high interest rates. Are you one of those people?
No, I would say I have a more moderate view. As I said, it's more boring It's not, I don't think it's going to be a barn burner, but I also think like, okay, that's okay. Like, you know, reasonable risk, reasonable return. Like there's nothing wrong with that, but I don't think, I guess there's the ways that you would see again, surprise on the upside would be rates come down more than people expect in the midterm. Immigration, legal and illegal, ends up being much more like it's sustained, that we sustained, like we had 3 million people last year. I think it was the most in history. If that continues for like a few years, right, that would be very bullish for residential, rental residential. I'm not forecasting it. I'm not on a political view. I'm just saying that would be sort of like, so both those things, either one of those things happening or both would see huge benefits to the rental residential industry. Real estate is a derivative of economic growth. It's people don't see it that way, but that's why data centers and is a derivative of AI growth today. It's really important to real estate to get the macro right. That's why I started with macro and I'm obsessed with macro. And if you don't get that macro right, you can't make money in real estate. You can get the micro right and still lose money in real estate. And you can get the micro wrong. But as long as you get the macro right, you still make money. Obviously, the best is you can do both, but macro is 80% of returns.
The general assumption in commercial real estate is, you know, you want a good economy so people can pay more rent. But what do you think is better or worse for the commercial real estate industry right now? A recession where interest rates decline sharply, 3%, maybe even lower, you tell me, or an actually good economy, which you think would be good for real estate, but you know, rates stay at 5% or higher.
That's easy. The entire real estate industry is praying for a recession.
Wow.
Yeah, cap rates are a multiple, right? 20 times income can grow 3%, right? But cap rates are 20 times that. So the multiples or your interest rates are far more consequential to returns. And that's so the entire industry is just praying and hoping that rates come down. And it looks like they're only going to come down if there's a recession. And that's for we took our hit last year. We took a markdown. We accepted that this was the new normal. But very few participants did or could. You know, you can if you don't have enough equity and cash. And I mean, we went into this very defensive. I was like freaked out. And it's defensive. We had $750 million in cash on $3 billion of total equity. So we were like 30%. Cash. And in retrospect, I wish I was 65% cash. You know, it's just like as defensive as we tried to be, like we weren't defensive enough.
And you still don't want to buy properties now. You still just want to be a lender.
Yeah, I would say like 80-20, like 80% lending, 20% buying today.
So when you say you're lending, I presume you are not a bank. Are you doing direct origination? Are you buying into, you know, a CMBS deals? Are you doing direct origination? By the way, if so, are you private credit?
Yep. Private credit. Oh my God. You said the words. Yes, we do almost entirely direct lending. Briefly, it was summer 2022, we started buying ABS because the ABS market just blew up in 22. And we were actively buying an ABS.
All commercial mortgage-back or everything,
well,
credit cards.
Technically, it's all called commercial mortgage-back, but we were only buying residential mortgage-backed securities.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
Because that's something we understood and we felt comfortable on. And we were buying it like maybe I think at 12, 13% yields for triple B rated, you know, residential mortgage-backed securities. And now that same mortgage, we just sold some of it. We sold some of it a week or two ago. And effective debt yield where somebody bought it from us was the debt yield was 5.15. Like, so inside the equity. So the credit markets have gone very risk on, like spreads are way tight. And so we obviously stopped buying that and we do direct lending. We've done, a lot, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars of direct lending, probably maybe even $1 billion of it or in our history.
Wow. One real estate developer I spoke to said that, interestingly, let's say in 2021, real estate private credit money was at 9%, and JP Morgan, if you want to borrow from them, it was 4%. Now, JP Morgan is at 8%, but real estate private credit has gone from like 8% to 9%. Is private credit real estate world still pretty, are lending conditions still loose, even though, you know, the banks don't want to lend?
Yes. So that's true. I mean, so if you go out to market, a lot of private credit funds were raised and they can't put the money out because there's no transactions, like nobody's buying. And so the spreads were 400 bips over, you know, over Fed funds. And now maybe they're 250 or maybe 300. I mean, they're very, very tight compared to where they wanted to be because there's just too much money against supply of money chasing too few transactions. And yeah, if you go borrow from JP Morgan or we have a line from JP Morgan, you're not at 8. A good bank loan wants to be, God, now, I mean, 150 to 250 over. So that would be like, you know, 6 to 7 or something. But we have a private credit box we've been doing pretty consistently for about a decade, which is we do mezz on multifamily. And that's the 14, 15, 16 generally these days. The private credit that you're talking about that is a senior loan for an acquisition, and then the private credit fund will lever that loan. They'll borrow against their position and lever it up.
Is it fair to say, I mean, I guess you are do private credit, but you obviously also own a lot of apartment buildings, but are you lending to private equity firms to do deals, or are you like, basically are you lending to sponsor versus non-sponsor deals?
We would be the direct lender. So a, you know, developer, and this is the thing surprising. The last, let's say 10 deals we did for mezzanine multifamily was to real estate developers who were building apartments. They basically had gotten over their skis. They had to build it. They couldn't stop. They had a lender. The lender was going to give them 70%. And now the lender carved it back from 75% to 55%. And they have a hole in their capital stack of 20%. And so we said, great, we'll write that check. We'll fill the hole. And so now we're essentially where the lender would have been in terms of risk profile. Our last dollar is where their last dollar would have been, and we're getting mezzanine rates. And so we've been doing multifamily development deals, but there's not that many deals because the flow is so little. And we haven't done, I don't think we've done a single recap of an existing deal, because every time we get under the hood of somebody who wants to recap an old deal, it's distressed or it's just, it's too hairy, and we've blinked.
Zooming out, you don't think that the level of debt to GDP is unsustainable. You think that you look at it in terms of service, how much can that debt be serviced and how much are people paying on that debt, and the drastic rise in interest rates, not that 5.5% is drastic, but going from 0 to 5.5% in a short time is pretty drastic. That has been concentrated not on the household, not on, you know, people owning their own homes and have a mortgage rate, but in the commercial real estate sector. What do you think is going to happen if interest rates stay at 5.5%? And we have this conversation in 2 years. What does that world look like?
Huge losses, a ton of distress, a bunch of regional banks go out of business. You know, you're seeing headline after headline of like foreclosures and then private equity funds getting launched and buying it. Sort of like this, and you know, a positive version is a creative destruction. That's what needs to happen with office. Right? We need to put $1 trillion of money into all that real estate to turn it over. Like it's a huge number, right? The subprime mortgage crisis at the end of the day was $1 trillion, right? Of just subprime mortgage. So it's comparable to the size of subprime mortgage in all days. So you would see a similar kind of distress and reinvestment cycle for definitely office, and then, you know, some chunk of residential that is poorly run and overlevered.
So if you have a somewhat grim pitch on real estate, grim view on real estate, what's your pitch to get people to involve with real estate with Fundbrise?
Oh, a problem is an opportunity.
Yeah.
Like new dollars, like to buy today is to buy, you know, it's a funny thing. I'm like anti-institutional. Institutional investors today are saying, well, we need, you know, really high cap rate, really high target return, blah, 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 blah. So you're not going to put the money out because your target returns are too high, but you did put the money out in 2021 when your target returns were too low. Yeah. So square that for me. So I believe that if you look at it simply, it's clearly a good time to be like, there's a lot of there's some distress, probably more distress, and that will play to the advantage of new buyers. And exactly how that ends up being a benefit, how rates come down or where you get it in growth, exactly how that plays out, anything that is in a Excel spreadsheet forecast, it's going to, you know, never right. I've done, thousands Excel spreadsheet forecasts. They're not predictive. They're not,
yeah.
They're just, it's some weird psychological phenomenon by the institutional investor. And so, but if you look at a big picture, you say, this is a much better time to buy than in the last 15 years, not since 2009-10 has real estate been so on its back heel. And you buy on the back heel and you sell on the front heel, the front foot.
But didn't you say earlier that you didn't want to buy real estate now? Or you're saying that there will be you're bullish on buying over the next 3 years?
Yeah, you said 2 years or something, right? Not like today. Yeah. Yeah, it's coming. I mean, there's guarantee. Yeah. It's just a question of the scale of it and how much it spreads to the rest of the economy.
So you think prices will continue to decline?
I think it'll be a bifurcated market, right? Where if you and how you want to play the bifurcation is like in the art of it. But yeah, there'll be a big wedge of the market where the most distressed being office, right? Like, you know, absolutely off the chart distressed. Like, I mean, this is again the macro, right? You could have underwritten a forecast Excel spreadsheet for office in 2019. And the entire sector has been trashed by nothing micro, all macro. Same thing with malls. Like I literally in 2001, I was in the mall business and I got out of the mall business and malls went to trash because of e-commerce. Like the macro is so much more consequential and the macro is very favorable as a buyer today.
All right, what do you think about the AAA sector of the office market? Like a, you know, very expensive building in New York where it's the nice law firms, Goldman Sachs, those. Do you think that like is going to be bad too?
I do. They hate when I say this. Yes. And it's because you have to play it out long enough. It's like the third order consequences. That's any great financial investor, you read about them, they always talk about it. You make the big money's made on the second and third order consequences. Everybody sees the first order consequences. So the first order consequences is that a lot of office buildings get foreclosed on. And so, okay, it's mostly the Class B office buildings, not the good office buildings that get foreclosed on. So you have this building from the 1980s or 1990s and it used to be $650 a square foot and somebody buys it for $100 a square foot. Okay, they buy for $100 a square foot. They put $200 a square foot into it. Now it's really nice. And now you're competing against something that's pretty darn nice. And the Class A is $1,000 a square foot. And so you have a pretty darn nice building that's charging a third of the rent. But until that building is charging a third of the rent, the Class A office building it doesn't have that competition. Right. So it's not till after you've seen hundreds or thousands of buildings bought, renovated, and charging a third of the rent, but still really nice, that those Class A office buildings start seeing the downward pull of the negative spiral that is office.
And is it fair to say, Ben, that the office lease term structure, weighted average maturity, whatever, is way, way longer than the multifamily world?
Yeah, I mean, a multifamily turns over a third of the building turns over every year, so it's like you could say that's 3 year, average 3 year maturity. Even though in theory that turns over every year, you know, not everybody leaves every year. So office is much longer. Fundrise has a whole floor. We leased it in 2019. It's 15,000 square feet. We pay $1 million a year for it, and there's three people there a day.
How do you feel about that?
I mean, this stuff, there's no way of gotten around that, right? This stuff happens. So the point is that like the office owner, when does that go to zero? 2027 for them.
Yeah.
So it's the delay, the lag, that's what's confusing the market. The conclusion is, if it hasn't happened yet, it's not going to happen.
I haven't looked at, in, you know, a few quarters into office occupancy rates. It's not getting better.
It's slow decline. It's a slow decline. Plus, I mean, office is pro-cyclical. The extent that you aren't seeing a lot of businesses get started, because you're not seeing, this is the thing of the hot market. You're not seeing people expanding office space, starting new companies other than AI. And so it's just a slow decline for office. They're trying to get back some of what they lost from work from home.
Ben, earlier you talked about how you're a real estate nerd, and I think if you want to be successful in financial asset class, you gotta get into the weeds. And I admire how you have, as well as you've delved into the debt world and the macroeconomic just beyond debt, about debt service, interest rate. So it's safe to say you think interest rates are extremely restrictive right now, and the Federal Reserve should cut, otherwise there'll be bad economic pain.
It's a little bit above my pay grade.
Yeah.
But I do think they're restrictive, and that I don't think that's up for debate. It's just the consequences of that take longer to play out than people's patience.
There we go. Well, Ben, thanks for coming on, being very generous with your time and insights. People can find you on Twitter at Ben Miller Eyes, and your company, they can find you on Twitter at Fundrise. Thanks again, and thanks everyone for watching.
Thanks, Jack.
Thanks for watching. Remember to check out vaneck.com/hodlfg to learn more about the VanEck Bitcoin Trust, ticker HODL.